Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. Freshly released from prison, New York Times reporter Judith Miller spent 3 hours today testifying before a grand jury investigating whether senior officials in the Bush administration knowingly leaked the identity of an undercover CIA agent in order to discredit the agent's husband and administration critic. Miller spent the past 3 months in jail, she says, to uphold the journalistic principle of never naming a confidential source. So why is she talking now? Joining us on the line, Richard Schmidt, who covers Washington for the Los Angeles Times. He's at the courthouse where the grand jury has been convening. And Rick, remind us, who is Judith Miller's source? Why is she talking about him now?
Her source is believed to be Louis Libby, who is Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff. The Times has not confirmed this, but sources close to the case tell us and others that that is the person that she is discussing and her conversations with him with the grand jury this morning.
But remind us, because it is a little confusing, because an attorney for Louis Scooter Libby was reported to have said yesterday that he told Miller's attorney a year ago that there was a waiver and that it was voluntary on Libby's part, and then she was free to speak. So there's some confusion about that.
It's one of the great questions of the case, one of the great mysteries right now in terms of the circumstances under which Libby provided a waiver and why she's decided to come forward now. It's been reported, I think the New York Times reported today, that this agreement that led to her release began with a phone call from one of her attorneys to Libby's attorney, and in which he subsequently provided an additional release allowing Miller to testify. And it raises the question why the attorney didn't 85 days ago seek a similar release. And that's a question that has yet to be answered. But the bottom line is that those sides have reached an accommodation that was satisfactory to the special prosecutor in the case. And ergo, we have Judy and a grand jury here this morning. Still, actually, it has not emerged yet. And apparently is still testifying before the grand jury at this hour.
Right. And we have heard other journalists say, and we should just throw this out there, that in some cases journalists fear that these waivers might have been coerced. They're not entirely sure of them, and so we may hear more about that being her feeling. But some more background. Valerie Plame, the agent, was identified by name and occupation in a column by Robert Novak 8 days after Plame's husband publicly criticized the administration's pre-Iraq war use of intelligence. We now know that presidential advisor Karl Rove was Novak's source for information about Plame, but apparently neither Rove nor Libby mentioned Plame by name to journalists. I know it's speculative. We're waiting to hear what the investigation will tell us. But what does that say, that neither of them claim to have said the exact name?
Well, it's going to be a test of a little-used federal law, two-decade-old law, that makes it a felony to disclose the identity of covert agents. And the question may boil down to whether or not you can effectively identify someone without naming that person by name. And there's a precious little legal precedent on that point, and it could be one of the issues that's ultimately litigated in this case if Pat Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor, decides to bring any charges.
Yeah. President Bush said at the time that whoever leaked the identity would be dealt with if they broke the law. If this investigation finds nothing illegal was done, is expected the president might say anything about whether it was unethical? Karl Rove, of course, is top advisor.
The administration position seems to have been shifting a little bit on this. It initially was that none of our folks were involved in, leaking information, and then it was none of our folks were breaking the law, and it became the test for remaining in the administration that you didn't break a law. It'll be a interesting political call for the administration if Pat Fitzgerald decides not to bring charges, but perhaps issues a report that describes conduct that may reflect badly on some of President Bush's and the Bush administration's top advisors.
Richard Smith.
We don't know what's going to happen. You know, he could come out next week and say, "I've tried like mad to make a case here, but there's no crime here that I can tell." He may decide the opposite. I think anybody who tells you they know what's going to be happening in this case after 2 years of parlor gaming in Washington really doesn't know what he's talking about. So we're going to have to wait for Fitzgerald to emerge with an answer here.
Thank you, Richard. Richard Smith, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times in Washington. Thank you.
You bet.
Well, the question of White House involvement in the Valerie Plame case adds to a growing list of worries in the Republican Party, what some have called a perfect storm of Katrina, Majority Leader Tom DeLay's indictment, and the war in Iraq. In fact, the majority Republican Party seems to have changed its agenda midstream from Social Security and tax relief to Reconstruction and poverty. This week, Majority Leader Tom DeLay resigned his post after being indicted by a Texas grand jury on conspiracy charges. Without the man known as the Hammer at the helm, are Republicans facing a power vacuum, and are the party faithful getting restless? To get an inside view of the Republican Party post-Tom DeLay, we turn to former Republican Congressman Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania. He now heads the conservative advocacy group Club for Growth. Pat, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
DeRoy Murdoch is a syndicated columnist with Scripps Howard News Service and a contributing editor to National Review Online. DeRoy, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Robin. How are you?
Good. And Whit Ayers, Republican pollster with the firm Ayers, McHenry & Associates, we welcome you.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be with you.
Thank you. And I want to start with DeRoy because, DeRoy, I heard you on conservative talk show host Laura Ingraham's radio program this week, and I'm reading from one of your columns. In both cases, you did not mince any words. You write, before the DeLay indictment, in fact, you write that the GOP congressional leadership, to them I say, you embarrass me, you embarrass yourselves. What did you mean?
Well, Robin, I was referring to this pattern we've seen for years now of incredibly out-of-control spending, not just the amount of spending, but the stupidity of the spending and the brazenness of the spending. We have seen a huge explosion in the number of pork barrel projects in various appropriations. For example, the highway bill under Bill Clinton.
Well, in fact, go ahead.
It had about 1,800 earmarks or pork barrel projects. The last highway bill, which was signed in August by President Bush, written by Republicans in his own party, had something like 6,400 earmarks worth $24 billion. And in the wake of Katrina, when you have about 1 million Americans now homeless, people living far from home, sleeping on floors, sleeping on cots, there's been a real effort to try to get Congressman Don Young, the head of the Transportation Committee, to scratch this bridge up in Alaska that will cost $223 million and serve a total of 50 people. That amount of money could give $250,000 per family to about 890 families to get relocated or to move back into New Orleans and rebuild. And his response to that idea was, quote, kiss my ear, unquote. That kind of an attitude, that sort of lack of concern or empathy for fellow Americans who are really in dire straits at the moment is the kind of attitude, unfortunately, you're seeing on the part of the Republican Congress. And I, who as a Republican and as a Reaganite, have got to walk around and talk to people I know who say, how can you possibly support a party that behaves this way? And it's becoming increasingly difficult to say that I do. And it's very frustrating and quite annoying. And I find many people in the grassroots who share my frustration.
Well, Pat Toomey, you worked with Tom DeLay, and yet you also now work with a group that's very much against this huge spending. Your response to what DeRoy is saying and what many others are saying?
I think DeRoy's right on the money. I think it reflects an even broader problem within the at least the leadership of the Republican Party and most of the elected Republicans. They seem to have perhaps even consciously abandoned the notion of limited government. And what's just ironic about this, it was the idea of limited government manifested in a 10-point contract with America that brought Republicans to power just a little over 10 years ago, and now they've just completely abandoned it. You know, between the prescription drug bill, which was a vast expansion of government, a transportation bill that DeRoy points to just the obscene level of spending, and now the notion that when a natural disaster seriously damages or destroys a city, that it is the role of the federal government to come in and provide unlimited resources to rebuild it. This is adding up to a serious political problem. as well as I think a problem of the philosophy of the party.
Well, Whit Ayers, I want to ask you about that. Whit Ayers, Republican pollster. We want to talk more about the spending concerns in a moment. But as you know, there are so many others. We've got Michael Brown's resignation from FEMA. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist facing a probe over insider share dealing. Peter Safavian, the head of the procurement for the Office of Management and Budget, arrested last week, charged with obstruction of justice. Today, a renewed focus on the plane scandal, questions about Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Louis Libby, and President's chief advisor, Karl Rove. And, of course, Iraq. The headlines keep coming from Iraq. And, again, I hear on the fiercely loyal Laura Ingraham talk show talk of finding new leadership. Do we have any polls? I mean, what are the people in the rank and file saying about their party?
Gee, Robin, after that litany, I think I'm going to go slit my wrist. Bad news tends to come in bunches, and Republicans have had more than their share of bad news lately. And because we are the party in power, we'll get the blame. But the silver lining for us is the Democrats are getting as much of the blame as Republicans. The country's in a funk. It's been in a funk. It was in a funk before Katrina. Worries about jobs being transferred overseas, worries about gas prices, worries about Iraq have put the country in something of a funk. The president's job approval is down, but so is the job approval for both Republicans and Democrats in Congress.
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, you know, an ABC Washington Post News poll in August found that 37% of Americans, only 37% of Americans approved of how Congress is doing its job. But, DeRoy, I want to bring you in here for the last minute before we take a break. The Republicans control Congress. Do you agree that, the blame is pretty evenly spread, or do Republicans have to worry a little more because they are in power?
Precisely, Robin. Republicans are in control. It is GOP Congress. The man in the White House is a Republican. And I think very easily by focusing again on the ideas of limited government and some sense of sacrifice on the part of politicians, the GOP could turn this around and appear to be leading us out of this situation rather than exacerbating it. I very much admire the fact that Nancy Pelosi, a liberal Democrat for whom I usually have very few words of praise, she stepped forward and said, look, I have $70 million worth of pork barrel projects in the highway bill. I'm willing to give back to the Treasury and use that for Katrina relief. She stepped up to the plate as a liberal Democrat from San Francisco. And I'm waiting to see Republican members come forward and do this. And
that's true, Robin. But keep in mind that the Democrats'
attitude that we don't want to hand any of this money back. We got it. We're going to use it for our advancing our own careers. That's very, very shameful from the party of Ronald Reagan.
Go ahead. One last thought.
But I'm glad to hear that Nancy Pelosi has done something worth admiring here. The fact is the Democrats have no alternative. And the Republicans had a contract with America. They had an explicit agenda that they had set out as an alternative to Democratic control back in 1993 and 1994. The Democrats have nothing comparable right now. Basically, what they have done is say no and obstruct, and for them to come back into power, they've got to present a credible alternative governing philosophy, which they have not done, and I see no prospect of them.
That's Whit Ayers, a Republican pollster, speaking about how the Democrats aren't looking so great either. But we're talking about the Republican Party right now with DeRoy Murdoch, syndicated columnist with Scripps Howard News Service, a contributing editor to National Review Online, and former Republican Congressman Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania. And we're wondering, political scientist James Thurber said Tom DeLay was like Tito, ruling with fear and rewards, and without him, the Republican Party will balkanize. Is that already happening? More on the future of the Republican Party when we come back. You're listening to Here and Now. And we're back with our Republican Roundtable, speaking with former Congressman Pat Toomey, Republican from Pennsylvania, who now heads the Club for Growth, a conservative advocacy group, DeRoy Murdoch, a syndicated columnist with Scripps Howard News Service and a contributing editor to National Review Online, and Whit Ayers, Republican pollster. And Whit, I want to start with you. Your thoughts first on political scientist James Thurber comparing Tom DeLay to Tito.
James Thurber had a great quotable quote with Tito, but let's not write Tom DeLay's political obituary prematurely. He has not been convicted. He has said this is a partisan witch hunt. if he is acquitted of this charge, he is going to come back stronger than ever, basically having this partisan witch hunt charge verified. So I think it's premature to write Tom DeLay off completely. But sure, there's some problems right now, and we've got to have a positive agenda that does some of the things that Pat and DeRoy have been talking about.
Well, in fact, you say premature to write him off, but DeRoy, I'm wondering if you're saying write him off.
Well, I've never been terribly impressed with Tom DeLay. I read a book by Elizabeth Drew a few years back that said when he became majority whip, he has instructed his staff that they should not schedule any meetings with lobbyists until and unless they donated, I believe it was either $5,000 or $10,000 to the National Republican Campaign Committee. Now, that sort of stuff is very disturbing, and that never should have happened. And if that's the sort of ethical culture that he's developed, basically pay to play, that's wrong. I think that's totally inappropriate. And it has been under Tom DeLay when all of this spending and this pork barrel and this return to unlimited government has taken place. So I've not been impressed with him. I'd very much like to see him step aside permanently and see somebody like Jeff Flake or someone like Mike Pence, people who are dedicated to the ideas of limited government and free market enterprise, go back in and run the House the way it should be run, not as a giant feather bedding operation.
That's DeRoy Murdoch. I want to get Pat Toomey in here.
Yeah, Robin, well, a couple of things. One, I do think this is probably the biggest challenge to the Republican Party in Washington since Newt Gingrich was deposed. And keep in mind, of course, the party survived that, which seemed like quite a calamity at the time. DeLay's great strength and the three big things that he's done is he's held the party together on tough votes with a remarkable discipline. He's been able to raise very substantial sums of money for members of Congress, Republicans, candidates, and helped to grow the majority that way for the most part. And he has engaged a lot of corporate America and lobbying groups to be helpful to the party. In a level that hadn't happened in the past. The big question is, number one, does he survive all this and come back stronger than ever, which I think is actually fairly likely. But number two, in the meantime, how much has he institutionalized these talents that he brought to Washington? And I think you may discover that these have been institutionalized to a more significant degree than people expect. So I think it's going to be much more difficult to get a very tough vote done now with Tom DeLay in this position, but certainly not impossible. I think the fundraising is going to continue to go very, very well for Republicans. This is a tough election cycle that we're going into anyway, but Witt hit the nail on the head earlier when he made the point that the saving grace for Republicans is going to be that the Democrats have absolutely no ideas about anything. And you just, it's very, very hard to see that they could take back control.
Well, we'll do the Democrats at another time. But I guess, Whit, I want to ask you, Pat Toomey is talking about what's been institutionalized. And, you know, there's a whiff in the air that one of the things that might have been institutionalized as well as a culture of corruption, it's being called by some Democrats, arrogance, you know, a party too long in power. You as a pollster, how do you advise Republicans to navigate that?
Well, it's just fundamentally not true. that also
but there's
helps.
Perception becomes reality, and we have all these cases lined up. And
you have the Democratic perception that they are trying to make into reality, but they haven't succeeded in doing that yet. But the way you do it is by acting ethically and honestly and above board and moving ahead with an agenda that people care about. Ethics has become, to a certain extent, partisanship by another name. And I think that there's got to be a lot more substance behind those charges than we've seen now. Like with the case with Bill Frist, I think he's going to be completely exonerated of that, and I think it'll turn out to be a tempest in a teapot.
Do you agree?
There's got to be more substance to that than I think than just rhetoric, and that's basically what's behind it so far.
DeRoy, jump in here. Do you agree?
Well, I think what the Republicans ought to do is go on the offensive rather than the defensive. They ought to come up, if it's not the contract with America, they can call it the to-do list for America or whatever, and pick a half dozen issues they're going to focus on between now and the end of the year and another four or five next year, whatever the number is, and literally publish them, put them on a list, and dedicate themselves to get X number of things done within a limited time, get the Senate and House leadership, and focus on that. We can talk about those issues, debate those issues, push those through, and we'll have something positive to talk about rather than these unfortunate and very tragic circumstances.
Go
on the
offense.
That's what they ought to do. And the president should lead the effort. The president should come up with the list with them and sit down on a regular basis with members, not just the leadership, but the caucuses of both the Senate and the House, and get a plan together and move on it.
That brings my last question. Pat Toomey, I want to throw it to you. How much is President Bush responsible for what has happened here and now from as going forward, holding the party together in the vacuum that Tom DeLay's absence will cause? Did he delegate too much power to Tom DeLay and advisor Karl Rove, both of whom now have a cloud over them?
No, I wouldn't say that he's delegated too much. I mean, the Congress is a separate branch of government, and it is appropriate and inevitable that leaders will emerge in Congress who will, will have their own ideas and their own vision. The president, clearly, with respect to his responsibility, his share of the responsibility for spending, I think he does deserve some of the blame here. I think, as a practical matter, he decided relatively early on that he had a finite amount of political capital. He had some very big and ambitious priorities that he wanted to get done. It included a war that was controversial, included large tax cuts, and included, I think, unfortunately, a prescription drug plan and some other things. And they just decided that in order to get those things done, they would have to just allow Congress to spend what it wants. I think that's an unfortunate decision. I think it was made, but I think they'd better do something about that now. And I do think it's important for the president to assert the leadership that the party needs. I do think they need to get some things done, as Roy has suggested. I think offsetting some of the spending for Katrina is a part of it. I think making some constructive steps on Social Security reform, it would be really, really important, and making some of the tax cuts permanent.
That's former Republican Congressman Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, who now heads the Conservative Club for Growth. DeRoy Murdoch, syndicated columnist with Scripps Howard News Service and a contributing editor to National Review Online. And we also spoke with Whit Ayers, Republican pollster with the firm Ayers, McHenry & Associates. Gentlemen, thank you all, and please come back.
Good being with you,
thank
Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
And this quick correction, the arrested former OMB staffer I referred to earlier is David Safavian, not Peter Safavian. I'm sure our panel is thrilled that I am mentioning him again. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from
And Now. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin today announces his dream team of experts to work on a vision to rebuild New Orleans. Architects around the country are weighing in and urging the city not to squander this chance to create a great American city. David Lee is an architect and urban planner at the Boston firm Stull & Lee. He also teaches at the Harvard Graduate School of Design, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
And David, first of all, I want to ask you the overarching question. Mm-hmm. Do you agree that New Orleans will become the great city it was, or will there be a different city emerging?
Well, I think it's going to be a different city. When we talk about the great city it was, you have to figure out when. At what point was it the great city? I think everyone who spent any time there with any sort of level of sensitivity about cities knew that New Orleans was built on a crumbling foundation socially and economically and to some extent physically. And so when we talk about a great city, it can't be a city with extreme dichotomies between the haves and the have-nots and such concentrations of people who are poor and disenfranchised. The thing that most people are afraid of is that you'll just sort of shave off the poor and have a city that's a wealthier and read white city.
Well, let me ask you more about that. You are mm-hmm. an African-American. What much was made in the aftermath of the largely poor African-American community that seemed to be isolated in the Ninth Ward? And so how do you, give us some of your ideas, how do you integrate a population, make it so that they can participate more in the economy of a city, but also keep the soul of their community intact?
Well, when we begin to talk about the Ninth Ward and so forth, we have to look at how people ended up there in the first place. It was the least desirable land in the city and the land most likely to flood in these kinds of occurrences. This isn't the first time this has happened. Mm-hmm. What we need to do is sort of separate the wheat from the chaff. For example, I remember hearing on BUR that in some cases, the schools were in such bad shape in New Orleans that students had to go across to a Burger King to use the restrooms. Mm. It seems to me that if we look at a way to rebuild the Ninth Ward, which is a win-win proposition, where, in fact, we can use natural systems to help with cleaning up air pollution and clearing up the aquifer. There are certain kinds of plant materials that do that sort of thing. Maybe looking at some of that reclaimed land there or reconstituted land there in a way that maybe some of the areas can be used as playfields and things perhaps related to schools such and parks, such that if they flood, okay, they dry out eventually and come back, but people don't lose their lives or their possessions. If, in fact, you were to begin to use those kinds of opportunities to build maybe a really first-class school school system, campus of schools, maybe design them in such a way that they're on hydraulic foundations, if you will. I mean, it's a little bit sky-gazing, but, you know, maybe the schools can rise on these hydraulic foundations 20 feet or 10 feet or whatever if they had to.
What about the old? As you picture it,
mm-hmm.
what does it look like? Do we still see the antebellum mansions?
Well, there are places where some of that stuff didn't get ruined. And I think certainly everything ought to be done to try to keep those things intact and protect them going forward. But, you know, at some point that was new architecture, too. Mm-hmm. And at some point we need to shed some of the vestiges of the old and look at what could be out in front of us and create a new architecture. I could see New Orleans as being the first 21st century city in this country. But one of the things I think is really crucial is to try to think about building technologies that perhaps, one, obviously are more environmentally sustainable, but also rely on less skilled labor to rebuild. They had a building type there called Camelbacks, which is kind of a shotgun house with a second level. But it's a house where each room is lined up right after the other room, and generally there's a door in each room. And it said you could fire a shotgun through the front door, and it would go out the back door and not hit anything.
So in some cities, they're called railroad apartments because you go right through.
And in New Orleans, for example, they've taken that to a high art. If you look at many of the houses in the Garden District, from a design standpoint, they are not dissimilar from what you find in Mid-City or the Lower Ninth or some of the other parts of New Orleans.
But and you wouldn't have to have a huge skill to build them.
Well, we have ways as architects of taking advantage of new technologies and thinking about how you build stuff. A lot has been made of this notion of taking trailers and putting them out someplace, and there are a whole other set of issues involved with that. However, manufactured housing has come a long way from the days of the old-fashioned trailer home, so to speak. And there are ways, for example, of in the factory building a lot of the elements that are required for a house. If some of those plants to actually manufacture, build these facilities could be located back in New Orleans, it could also become a source of employment.
I'm thinking, David, as part of your Urban Design Options Studio at the Harvard Graduate School of Design, you took a group of students to New Orleans a few years ago.
I had a group of students, and what we did was we took a neighborhood right in the center of the city, just beyond Louis Armstrong Park and not terribly far from City Park and not far from downtown. And we tried to envision how that area of the city could be reconfigured. I-10 took what was once a wonderful oak-lined boulevard, not unlike Commonwealth Avenue, for example,
here in Boston,
and literally built an overhead freeway there that wiped out the businesses and fragmented the community. Mm-hmm. One of the things that our students came up with was the idea of changing what was a border into what could be a seam that pulled people together rather than kept them separate. And to do that by identifying kinds of land uses that could, in fact, thrive or at least exist under the overpass.
Like gardens or...
Gardens, but also other buildings that could be built in a way that one wasn't even aware that the overpass was above. One of the things that could happen, perhaps, was you would actually build underneath it, and it just simply became a roof, if you will. The other thing is that was an area where prior to the I-10, and although with some difficulty they still do it, but that's where a lot of the bands marshaled for the Mardi Gras parades. Mm-hmm. So we also looked at perhaps ways of replacing that underneath with some facilities where you could actually build the floats and do that kind of thing, another kind of use that brought people together.
You better get those students' papers out. They might be needed. David Lee is an architect. He's an urban planner at the Boston firm Stull & Lee. He also teaches at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. Thank you.
Thanks again.
And we have this loose end to tie up. You might remember I spoke recently of my elderly mom, how we thought she'd lost her wedding ring, and painful as that was, how it also made me think of the many losses on the Gulf Coast. Many of you then sent your thoughts, your own stories of loss, but one of you sent your ring. It came taped in the center of a white piece of paper next to these simple typed words. I heard about your mother losing her ring, how lost she feels without it. This one is not a match, but maybe she won't notice, and maybe it will make her feel better. Well, what can I say? Except, as you may have heard, this is an embarrassment of riches. We were lucky enough to find Mom's ring, but I couldn't take this one even if we hadn't, not with so many people stripped of everything. So, if you sent it, would you please let me know how to get it back to you? If not, please know that it will find its way, maybe to a nursing home or a shelter, but to another hand that has weathered life's storms. You're listening to Here and Now. Okay, shifting gears. It all comes down to three games, or maybe more, for the Boston Red Sox to be in baseball's postseason. Why are we focusing on the Red Sox when so many other teams are playing? Well, because last year they were the World Series champions. And after being in first place by 5.5 games this past August, the Sox are now fighting for a chance to win the American League East. They're one game in back of the New York Yankees after last night's thrilling win against the Toronto Blue Jays.
Ortiz grounds it into left center. Here comes Damon. Here comes a win. A throw to the plate. Not in time. Red Sox win.
Yes, I vaguely remember it. Or was it a dream? That's the call as Big Papi David Ortiz drove in the game-winning run last night. The Red Sox play the Yankees in a three-game series starting tonight. So joining us in the studio with a little thought on this, only a game host, Bill Littlefield. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Robin.
It was around 10:30, I think, when that happened. So let's bang chests and do a Big Papi hug, which is what they do now.
Were this table not between us, I'm sure we'd do so.
Well, you know, for those across the country who may not have been, you know, staying up following the Red Sox, the crowd at last night's game was shouting, you know, MVP for David Ortiz, who sort of emerged as sort of, I don't know, Babe Ruth. He keeps winning every game for the Sox. But he's a front runner maybe, but also it could be the Yankees' Alex Rodriguez as a candidate for MVP.
Absolutely. I've never really been able to figure out how the voting goes in these sorts of things. Certainly, if the Red Sox do take 2 out of 3 from the Yankees this weekend and David Ortiz has a couple more game-winning hits, I would think that that would enhance his resume considerably for MVP voting.
I think they're going to, like, bronze him or something if that happens. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's get out our calculators and our
charts.
That's
what it takes,
and graphs.
If not an abacus.
It's so confusing. What needs to happen this weekend for either team?
Well, the Yankees go into this series a game up, so if they win 2 games, they're champs. Red Sox can't catch them. The Red Sox better win all 3. That would be my advice. Cleveland, if they win all 3 in Chicago, is in, meaning that somebody, either the Yankees or the Red Sox, the team that doesn't succeed in the Boston series, is out. And that's about as much sense as I can make of it.
It's very confusing. And there is this wild card. Right now, the Cleveland Indians are tied with the Red Sox for the AL wild card spot.
Mm-hmm.
And they're facing, is it the White Sox?
The White Sox, who are already in. And some people would say that leaves them little incentive to wear out their pitching staff in the last 3 regular season games. They're more interested in getting ready for the playoffs.
Well, so there you have it. I have no idea.
I was counting on that.
Never has the bumper sticker "One Day at a Time" been more important.
And we haven't even talked about the National League.
Well, let's do that.
Okay. Well, Houston looks very good for the wild card in the National League, although they lost last night and the Phillies crept a little closer to them. The Phils still have a kind of an outside chance should they run the table this weekend. But very likely Houston will be the wild card there.
Okay, and don't we have the Atlanta Braves?
Atlanta, San Diego, and St. Louis are okay, even though most people, they're in, even though most people would say it's not entirely fair that San Diego is playing anywhere after the 5th of October.
His name is Bill Littlefield. If you want to comment on that comment. Well, you know, it's so early in the season here in Boston, for those, again, listening in other places. Here in Boston, we've been saying this is way too early for all of this anxiety and people staying up late. And it is, isn't it?
Well, happily, at least it isn't happening on the West Coast somehow.
That's right.
You know, it would be a lot later. Yeah, it's great. I mean,
wait a second. West Coast. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
There is a real possibility here that these 3 games don't decide it.
The
Red Sox,
this weekend,
the
right?
Red Sox and the Yankees don't decide in the next three games, and they have to play some more next week. So, you know, hey, you know, get your sleep during the morning and then during the afternoon, so you'll be ready for the evening and the late night.
During the program,
absolutely.
Perhaps.
Take yeah, send it in.
Do you care to hazard a prediction? What is ultimately going to be the World Series?
I am the world's worst predictor. I would love to see Cleveland in the postseries just because they're such an exciting baseball team to watch right now. But that means either the Sox or the Yankees don't make it, and that's not so good for people around here, is it? Because people here want to see the Sox play the Yankees forever and a day more.
That's right. Only a Game host Bill Littlefield, of course, have more of all of this on his program this weekend on Only a Game. Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Actually, will you be doing the program since there's so many baseball games to watch?
We'll squeeze it in there somewhere, I'm sure.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Here and now. Hollywood has been mining plays since Hollywood began making movies. In fact, early movies were often no more than filmed plays, performed and shot right on stage. But today's movie audiences want more than staging and dialogue with their popcorn. They want action, realistic locations, booming soundtracks, and spectacle. Well, these expectations can make adapting a play for film particularly challenging. Theater does add a kind of credibility to movies. Plays by Mamet, Pinter, and of course Shakespeare are generally treated as highbrow, intelligent films. Well, David Auburn's Proof is the latest play to take the celluloid leap. Producer Andrea Shea takes a look at the film and the questions it raises about whether stage production should stay in the theater.
In Proof, playwright David Auburn examines the elusiveness of truth and the gray area between genius and madness. His main character, Catherine, wonders if she's inherited her father's mathematical brilliance, his dementia, or both. And the audience wonders along with her. Gwyneth Paltrow plays Catherine in the new film. Sir Anthony Hopkins is her dad.
How old were you when it started?
What?
You know, when you got sick.
26, 27. Is that what you worried about?
I've thought about it.
Just because I went buckhouse doesn't mean you will. This stuff is not strictly hereditary. They know that now.
John Madden directed Paltrow and Hopkins in Proof, the movie. He's no stranger to film or theater. He directed Shakespeare in Love, as well as the London stage production of Proof. And while Madden says working on the play gave him insight into making the movie...
It doesn't, I think, generally speaking, work to transfer a play wholesale to film. The media are unquestionably different. You need to find a solution, I think.
Which was tough, says Madden, because the play is set in one place during a very confined period of time. According to Robert Knopf, editor of the book Theater and Film, a Comparative Anthology, the hunt for such a solution often starts with a question.
Since plays are often set in one space, do you have to open this up to make it work on film?
Knopf says today's film audiences expect stories to move visually from place to place, so a play is usually opened up by setting scenes in various locations.
There's this expectation that you should open it up because film can take us anywhere, but for certain plays, that might not work, or really depending upon what the director sees in the play, how much they want to change it when they make it into a film.
Knopf cites director Mike Nichols' 1964 film version of Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf as a play that didn't need to be changed or opened up much at all. Most of George and Martha's vicious bickering erupts in the couple's living room.
Listen to me, Martha. You've had yourself an evening. You've had yourself quite a night. You can't cut it out just whenever there's enough blood in your mouth. We're going on, and I'm going to have at you, and it's going to make your performance tonight look like an Easter pageant. I want you to get yourself a little alert, I want a little life in you.
Stop that!
Pull yourself together. I want you on your feet and slugging, because I'm going to knock you around, and I want you up for it.
All right, George, what do you want?
An equal battle, baby, that's all.
You'll get it.
I want you mad.
I'm mad.
Get madder.
Don't worry about it.
Good girl. We'll play this one to the death.
Yours.
You'll be surprised.
Yeah.
Here comes the little tots. You'll be ready for this.
I'm ready for you.
Here we are.
Like Virginia Woolf, Proof is an intimate four-person ensemble. Director John Madden set much of the high drama in the house Catherine shared with her father, but the camera does venture outside on a few occasions. Boston Phoenix theater critic Carolyn Clay has seen Proof on stage many times and says Madden might have done better to keep the characters closer to home.
Watching it, I was very conscious through most of it of a little desperation in the opening
it up. You know, we went dress shopping, we went to the airport, and one was kind of conscious of the fact that he was really working overtime.
But Clay says Madden's film succeeds in doing something the stage play just can't. Fast-paced editing allowed the director to heighten the tension and create an intense sense of momentum visually. Madden also says the camera gave him the power to hone in on, follow, and amplify Catherine's inner struggle.
And I think movies can do this extraordinary thing that if you take one character's point of view very strongly, it lends a kind of quality to the experience that only film can achieve. Stage is, by definition, a more objective medium. You're in the same relationship with all the characters. But to be experiencing a story via one character is something that cinema does very, very well.
While cinema has a leg up in many ways, Clay says theater has the upper hand as literature. She says symbolism, metaphor, and imagery work best in a play.
On the stage, it can be about poetic language. It can be about what the situation is a microcosm of. But in film, it's story, story, story.
And that's one more reason why making a film into a play can be so tricky. Screenwriters run the risk of gutting a play's original language when rewriting the story to suit film. Playwright David Auburn adapted his script, and much of the dialogue remains intact. Actor Anthony Hopkins plays the math genius father in Proof and says he knew he had a stage-to-screen adaptation in his hands after a quick glance at the text.
Well, first of all, I didn't see this play. I don't know the play, and I didn't see it on stage. But in reading the script, I could see how it was a play because it's quite wordy.
Robert Knopf, editor of the anthology Theater and Film, says streamlining a play's wordiness keeps things tight and can have its benefits.
It's just a question of what you're trying to achieve. If you're trying to make a lot of money, probably you don't want as many words.
At the same time, Knopf says there's no hard and fast rule for what makes an adaptation successful. He also says there are times when dialogue-heavy films, films that are more like plays than movies, have defied expectations.
There was a film called My Dinner with Andre that was just two people sitting down and talking over dinner, and nothing happened but two people talking. And yet the film, for a small independent film, was quite successful, and of course there was no reason to open it up, and there was no reason why you would want to get rid of the words, because it was about two people sitting and talking over dinner.
You know, it may be, Wally, that one of the reasons that we don't know what's going on is that when we're there at a party, we're all too busy performing.
Uh-huh.
You know, that was one of the reasons that Grotowski gave up the theater. He just felt that people in their lives now were performing so well that performance in the theater was sort of superfluous. And in a way, obscene.
Director Louis Malle's My Dinner with Andre, starring Andre Gregory and Wallace Shawn, came out in 1982. A lot has changed since then, especially audiences, says Ty Burr, film critic for the Boston Globe. He says many people go to the movies expecting a visual ride and often don't have patience for too much talk. Filmgoers like star power, but Burr says Proof might surprise them.
If you just wandered into the multiplex wanting to see the new Gwyneth Paltrow movie, you would come out thinking it was interesting and kind of wordy. Because if you don't know that, you have to adjust, you have to change gears a little bit, that it might seem a little bit like a teledrama or something because it's characters and dialogue and ideas and it's not tremendously visual. But has it become cinema?
If your idea of cinema involves Tom Cruise in an F-14 or any movie by Stanley Kubrick, your answer would probably be no. But ultimately, the moviegoer decides. And as more and more people are choosing to park themselves on the couch rather than at the multiplex, some wonder if the home theater is really the house directors of stage-to-screen adaptations should play to.
Producer Andrea Shea on the screen adaptation of the play Proof. For more on the film, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, Emiko Tamagawa, Vince Fairchild, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugertz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Lara Farrar, Jessica Gerard, and Angela Kim. And special thanks today to New England Sports Network for our chance to relive the Red Sox magic once again in our sports report. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.